I'm going to start by reading a little story. This is one of my very favorite stories from spiritual literature. It's from the book, The Little Flowers of St. Francis, and it's one of the most charming and inspiring. It's the story of St. Francis and his perfect joy. I first heard this. He talks about Santa Maria degli Angeli. It's a where he and the monks used to live when they were first getting started. And it was just at that time, this little, how many of you have been to Santa Maria degli Angeli? Oh, wow. you all know how wonderful it is. It originally was just this little bitty hut. And when there was just a handful of brothers, that's where they would go. And now they've built a big cathedral all around it and all sorts of chapels and auditoriums and so forth. But it's just the purity of the inner life can be felt there. So it's in kind of medieval English, translated from Italian, obviously, but it's just so charming. This is the story of how, while St. Francis and Friar Leo, that was his closest brother, were on a journey, he expounded unto him those things which are perfect joy. Once when St. Francis was coming from Perugia to Santa Maria degli Angeli with Friar Leo in the winter, and the very great cold vexed him sore, he called to Brother Leo, who was going before, and spake after this manner, "Friar Leo, albeit the minor friars in every land set a great example of holiness and of good edification, nevertheless, right and note diligently that therein is not perfect joy." And when St. Francis had gone further, he called unto him the second time, "O Friar Leo, although the minor friar should give sight to the blind, make straight the crooked, cast out devils, make the deaf to hear and the lame to walk, and the dumb to speak, and what is a greater thing, should raise who have been dead 4 days, write that therein is not perfect joy." Going a little farther, he shouted loudly, "O Friar Leo, if the minor friar knew all languages and all sciences and all the scriptures, so that he was able to prophesy and to reveal not only things to come, but also the secrets of consciousnesses and souls, write that therein is not perfect joy." And going yet farther a certain space, St. Francis shouted loudly, "O Friar Leo, although the friar minor should know to preach so well that he should convert all the infidels to the faith of Christ, write that therein is not perfect joy." And this manner of speech continuing for a full 2 miles, Friar Leo with great wonder asked and said, "Father, I pray thee in the name of God to tell me wherein is perfect joy." And St. Francis answered him, "When we shall be at Santa Maria degli Angeli, thus soaked by the rain and frozen by the cold and befouled with mud and afflicted with hunger, and shall knock at the door of the place, and the doorkeeper shall come in anger and shall say, 'Who are ye?' And we shall say, 'We are two of your friars.' And he shall say, 'Ye speak not truth. Rather, ye are two lewd fellows who go about deceiving the world and robbing the alms of the poor. Get you hence,' and shall not open unto us, but shall make us stay outside in the snow and the rain and cold and hungry, even until night. Then if we shall bear such great wrong and such cruelty and such rebuffs patiently, without disquieting ourselves and without murmuring against him, and shall think humbly and charitably that that doorkeeper really believes us to be that which he called us, and that God makes him speak against us, O Friar Leo, write that here is perfect joy. And if we shall persevere in knocking, and he shall come forth enraged and drive us away with insults and buffetings as importune rascals, saying, 'Get hence, vilest of petty thieves, go to the hospice, shall we not We here you shall not neither eat nor lodge.' If we shall bear this patiently and with joy and love, O Friar Leo, write that herein is perfect joy." and goes on and on. And then finally, and hear the conclusion, Friar Leo. Write that here and in this is perfect joy. And therefore hear the conclusion, above all the graces and gifts of the Spirit, which Christ grants to his friends, the greatest of these is self-conquest. And Swami explains this story, and he said most people don't understand it. And in fact, in all of Christianity, the little flowers of St. Francis have actually distorted the two true teachings of Christ and Francis, because what they interpret this story is that perfect joy is suffering. And that's not what Francis is saying. He's saying perfect joy is, no matter what happens, the conquest of the self. And just as we read in the Festival of Light every week, in the past, suffering and sorrow were the coin of man's redemption. That's how most people interpret this story. For us now, the payment has been exchanged for calm acceptance and joy. And that's what St. Francis was telling us. It wasn't that you love the beatings, but if you can just say, I accept it, nothing can disturb my equanimity of heart and mind, then you know you have perfect joy. And so when we try to explore how to deepen and strengthen our inner life, this is such a good place to start. This thought of not having, as Jyotish was saying, we are a character in a dream and we identify that character as supremely important. But when we begin to realize that that I in this dream is nothing but a figment, nothing but an image in God's dream, and we play our parts well, but the more and more we break the hold of identification and of separation from other people and competition with other people. I mean, it's such a ingrained part of our mentality. I can do this a little bit better. Watch how good I did this. I'm different from you. This group is different from that group. On and on it goes. And even in the spiritual community, even in our life here, it's just a part of the ego. And the more and more we can say, I love, Swami put it so beautifully. He said, we should strive to always put our egos in a position of disadvantage. So it's not like the ego has ascendancy, but always look at what can I do that will make me take a back seat and not rush forward. I mean, even from little children, there's always the kid in the class who, when the teacher says, who knows the answer? There's that little kid goes, oh, call on me. And even when we're little, we think, I don't want to be that kid. I don't want to be that way. But then the world says, but that's important. That kid's going to go on and get the scholarship. That kid's going to get the good job. And we have to convince ourselves to put the ego in a position of disadvantage. And so if there's somebody in our life that we don't get along with, who rubs us the wrong way, perhaps, we should go out of our way to be friends with that person. We should find ways of making that person feel that they are important to us. Why? Because we disconnect from that sense of I am important. Anandi sent me something from Master's teachings recently that I had never stumbled upon, and I found it tremendously helpful. It's Master's peace and harmony prayer. And Master teaches us, if there's someone that you have disharmony with, this is a technique he gave, visualize that person very clearly, and for 1 minute pray, Lord, fill Bob with peace and harmony, peace and harmony, and do it with tremendous concentration for 1 minute. And then follow that for 15 seconds by saying, Lord, fill me with peace and harmony. Fill me with peace and harmony. And at first, the ego resists. I don't want that person to be blessed. You know, look at all the bad things that person did to me. And then, but then if you can put the ego in a position of disadvantage, and Master said to do that 3 to 5 times a day. And I love Master's, the way he puts things. He said, I guarantee you, if you do it 5 times, it will work 5 times a day, and do it repeatedly. But to look at all the things in our life where we try to, you know, it's like a knee-jerk reaction. The ego tries to push itself forward. And the more and more we can just be willing to let that little self go by the wayside and let the bigger stand in the truth of your own being. Last year, it was so charming at our school award ceremony for our Ananda Living Wisdom School. The little kindergartners in our school, they're getting training that, you know, we haven't gotten to our adulthood. And they played this game with their teacher, little self, big self. And when they're angry or selfish or talking too much or whatever it might be, they say, that's your little self. But if they can think of other people first and share their toys or share a special treat in their lunch, that's their big self. And they played the game, little self, big self. And one little boy, I mean, he was just a teeny little guy, kindergarten student. And the students came up and the teachers lovingly gave them an award. And the teacher was saying that, and the littler ones are more shy, you know, they're really embarrassed to be up there. And the teacher said, one day this little student came up to me and said, Narani, I don't even remember my little self anymore. And they're learning that from the beginning. But it's never too late. We can pick it up. We can say, that's my little self. I don't want to be in my little self because my little self is limiting. My bigger self is who I want to be. And so the more we can do that, and as I said, put the ego in a position of disadvantage. Always look for the opportunity, and they're there if you look for them. And when you can choose it, it is so glorious. I've shared with some of you this story many years ago. Another woman and I were, this was the day before computers and databases, we were working on our big Christmas mailing, and it was a week-long project to get, you know, all the labels typed up and all the envelopes and the envelopes stuffed, and there was another woman and I, and we were working on this, and we knew it was going to be a week of really intense work to get it out. And we were, you know, doing it happily, and then Swami Kriyananda pulled up in his car, and he said, I'm driving to Los Angeles to give some lectures, and we're going to be staying at the Home of Friends, and we're going to be going to Disneyland, and there's two of you working on this project, and I have room in my car for one. Which of you would like to go? And that was probably not the right question, which of us would like to go, but you know, it was such a wonderful experience for me because I looked at that other woman and I thought, there's no way in the world she's going to be able to refuse this. But I think I can. And I said, you go, I'll stay, knowing that it meant twice as much work for me. But you know, that night I had one of the most holy experiences of my life where I really had a dream of Christ coming to me and blessing me. And I knew it was because of that, being able to put the ego in a position of disadvantage. So just be looking for ways all the time. It becomes a wonderful game, a wonderful game. Swami talks about how when they would, his first year at Mount Washington, when they were having the Christmas banquet, and it was something they had been looking forward to all year round, and they'd been cooking for days and days, and they were going to have this wonderful meal with their guru and bask in the bliss of his being. And then they were setting the tables, and they counted the places, and then just right at the last minute, all these people came rushing in, outsiders. And the brothers there, the monks, willingly, happily gave up their places, went and ate in the other room so that these visitors could come. And later someone told Master, and he just got this beautiful smile, and he said, oh, that's what pleases me. And so who won? Who lost? What's day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. When we can have the strength inside ourselves to say, when, as Master said, when this I shall die, then will I know who am I. And so that will lead us to an ever-deepening inner life and an inner relationship with Master. Another very important thing is to try to live always in a sense of what I'll call restful aloneness. Not alone in your room and kind of restless and, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to make a phone call. And, you know, you just see people, particularly being in Los Angeles, you know, I mean, pretty soon they're going to just implant those phones in their brains, you know, because, I mean, everybody's just walking down the street talking all the time, you know, and then you have to, oh yeah, there's something in their ear. And, but to be in a state of restful aloneness, you know, even the more you practice it, the more you realize that those moments are so delicious. And you can even be practicing aloneness in the middle of a conversation with another person. If someone's talking, you don't have to be thinking, well, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? You just rest in yourself, and you're alone. And it's so peaceful, and it's so beautiful. And if we can make the point of reference not ourselves and other people, but ourselves and God, it makes a huge difference in your life, because we're always thinking, always in the back of our mind, it's a very habitual thing. What are people thinking about me? Do they like me? Do they want to have lunch with me? Are they mad at me? Did I offend them? You know, so much energy goes on about what are other people thinking about me? How are they relating? And if you just turn that off, it's not that you treat people unkindly, but you just don't make it be your point of reference. Your point of reference becomes you and God. And then all of that other tumult about other people just kind of recedes into the background, and you just walk blissfully in a state of restful aloneness. I remember some years ago, in the early years of Ananda, we had many yogis visit us from India. And this was in the early days of the spiritual movement in the West, in California. And some of them, I don't even remember their names, but they were really yogis. Some of them didn't speak English. They didn't have a following. They didn't have an entourage. They didn't have a work. They just were yogis who had come to the West, and they came to Ananda. And one yogi, Swami, was giving a satsang, and then he was taking questions afterwards. He spoke English. And I was pretty new on the path. And for some reason, I asked him this question, which to me now is interesting. I don't know why I asked this question, but I asked him, how do you develop the kind of long-term commitment to keep you on the path for your whole life? And his answer totally puzzled me and took me many years to kind of work out what he was trying to say. He just said, in a seeming non sequitur, never compare yourself to other people. And I thought, what's that got to do with staying on the spiritual path? But it has everything to do, because it takes us out of ourself. And when we're comparing ourselves with other people, it's the separation and competition of the ego. Oh, he's so spiritual. She's not so spiritual. You know, I'm more spiritual than them, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's like everything becomes broken down, and it's outside of yourself. But again, if you can stop comparing, just rest in that aloneness, then you love everyone. Yeah, everyone becomes not a threat, not someone that you need to get to like you or make you, that you want to anything, you know. that you need something from, but just becomes an expression of God's joy. So don't compare yourself to other people. And Master was very, very strong. Somehow it's been striking me a lot in his writings about not speaking negatively, not only about other people, but at all. Just don't talk about negative things that have happened, about things that people have done that bother you. And in The New Path, Swami tells that story. It's in the chapter on attunement, which is a wonderful chapter. But it's the story of when Swami was asked to participate in this installation of officers at a Masonic lodge. And there, as it turned out to be a fiasco, and the different factions ended up arguing, and people stomped out, and it just, you know, dissolved in all the things we're talking about of the ego. And afterwards, Master asked him, "How did it go?" And he said, "Well, sir," and it was not as everything we'd hoped. And Master said, "It was a fiasco, wasn't it?" And Swami said, "Yes." And he said, "Don't speak of it." And Swami thought, "Well, I'll never see those people again. It's not about our organization. What difference does it make?" But Master said, "Negative expression about anything opens the mind up to negative thinking." And so just... it's something we all, it's such an easy thing to get into, but one leads to the other. If we compare ourselves to other people, then we'll speak negatively of them. But if we always say, "I'm a free soul, I'm just at rest in my aloneness," there's no need to speak negatively about anything. And another thing Master said, which is so fascinating and flies totally in the face of modern psychology, he said, "Never speak about past negative experiences." And I want to read the quote here because it's important. He said, "Don't speak of past bad of hurts or past bad experiences." And Master says, direct quote, "To remember bad experiences and dwell upon them is an abuse of God's gift to us of memory." So how often that's all we do, talk and talk and talk about, "Oh, this terrible thing happened, go with this person, did it to me." That's an abuse of the God-given memory. He said we should only use our memory to recall uplifting and positive experiences, and that frees us from karma. So all of these things, the more we can just have our point of reference, not what this person did to me, does this person like me, but just you and me, God, you and me, and we walk through this life always at rest. Another thing we can do to deepen our inner life is to, it's similar to what we've been talking about, but if we always live at our center and just realize that is our point of reference, nothing outside ourselves. And then Swamiji says so beautifully, he said, "Events are shaped by people who live at their center." And if you want to be effective in this world, spiritually, practically, on any level, it starts by being centered in yourself. And from that place to, as Jyotish was saying, to listen, to always be listening. And what stops us from listening? The restlessness of the mind. We start to go into meditation and then, "Oh, I got to do that, got to do that." I think it was last year, Nitai was giving a class and he gave a tip that I have found very, very useful. He said, when you get up from your meditation, while we're meditating, okay, we're focused, but that transitional time between meditation and activity is one of the most important points of our day. Because if we can build a bridge from the effort of our sadhana, listening, praying, feeling God's presence in our heart, and then rather than just jumping up from our meditation and getting our emails and looking at our calendar and making the phone calls, but do some activity where you are consciously practicing the presence of God. To my humble confession is, I make the beds. You know, I get up from meditation and I think I will do this action with the consciousness of God. And then I will, from there, step by step. And then finally, the more you can extend that from, okay, now I'm going to make breakfast, but I'm going to do it with the same consciousness that I had in meditation, and try to build those bridges throughout the day. And when you start feeling, oh, I've lost it, I'm not listening, I'm not feeling God's presence, stop and meditate again, wherever you are, at your desk, not driving probably, but when you get to the parking lot. I remember many years ago when we were living in the ashram in San Francisco, Laura Herman, who was living there with us, she was working in, I believe, as an emergency room nurse, or at least as a nurse in a hospital. Anyway, she said at lunchtime she would go out into her car in the parking lot of the hospital and just meditate there. And then she'd come back, and all of the staff would say, how are you so calm all the time? Everybody else is running around crazy. So build those bridges throughout the day of the peace of meditation, and bring it into your activity. And then it becomes this wonderful circuit. Then when the day is done and you're free to focus totally in meditation again, you realize, I haven't ever left this place. I did a few things outside, but I brought the peace of meditation out into the world, and I've brought it back on a beautiful thread of God remembrance. And all of these are ways that we can strengthen our inner life so that the outer world is a pleasant dream, but the inner life is our reality. And it is a beautiful garden, resplendent with flowers of harmony and peace and restfulness and the joy of God.